Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone. And now, here is your host, the lovely, delightful, insightful, and all-around great gal, Ms. Barbara DeLong.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Nightlight. We have an old friend back with us tonight. We have Robert Sullivan IV. And for those of you who don't know him, he is a philosopher, historian, antiquarian, jurist, mystic, lay theologian, radio, TV personality, writer, lawyer, and in his spare time, a best-selling author of many books. We've spoken with him about his The Royal Arch of Enoch and Cinema Symbolism 1 and 2. Tonight, we're going to focus on his newest endeavor, which is A Pact with the Devil, which is his foray into writing fiction. And after having read the book, I would say that it was a very successful trip. Robert, welcome to the show.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you for having me on Nightlight tonight. It's a pleasure again to be here. Always great to be on your show. And again, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Well, I have to tell you, you have been a challenge here and there, and a pleasure and a surprise with all of your books. Royal Arch of Enoch, I had to learn a whole bunch about Freemasonry before I understood what was going on in the book, but I thank you for that education. And Symbols in the Cinema changed the way that I have looked at movies forever. And your newest one, A Pact with the Devil, holy mackerel. It's fiction, and I'm so used to your other writing, I didn't expect the story that I got, but it was amazing, and the research you did and the material in it is fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. Of course, I hate it when somebody leaves themselves open for 2, 3, or 4 sequels when I get to the end of the book, but I guess that's understandable.
Well, right. I mean, I definitely, when I was writing it, I knew that I wanted to do a sequel to it, possibly a couple others. And I'm actually writing a sequel to it right now, and actually some like prequel stories to it also. But one of the things that I definitely wanted to do was I didn't want to have a cliffhanger ending. That I did not want to have happen. I wanted to make sure that when you got done reading the book, that the murder mystery was solved. I didn't want to leave that hanging out there. I was very conscious of that. And I kind of used the last two chapters of the book to set up the next one. I believe I've mentioned this on other shows with you, of course, was the story came to me in a dream, the template of it. I enjoyed writing it. I used, as you say, I used real research in it, meaning, some of the books mentioned are real. Some of the places are real. I have studied witchcraft quite extensively. In fact, I did my college thesis on it. And, you know, I incorporated, you know, my knowledge from doing that, remembering back on that. And I still have a lot of the books that I used when writing that to rely on this. So I was really happy with the way it came out. I thought it, you know, I thought it was interesting. I thought it was a page turner. I liked the characters. I thought it had some very dark humor in it. But there it is. There's A Pact with the Devil. It's out. You can get it now. And I'm actually working on 5 books right now, including its sequel and some prequel stories as well.
Wow. It fascinates me now. You know, I write, but every now and then when I get an idea for a work of fiction, I keep thinking, oh my goodness, can I transfer into that different style of writing where you have dialogue going on and everything? It just, it fascinates me how well you fell into it. And, you know, you achieved, I'm sure what your aim was, because you forgot that you were reading a book, but it was more like you were listening to conversation.
Yeah, well, I wanted that to be the case. I wanted to have a very natural flow to it. One thing that I definitely did was, well, I mean, you know, it's a good question you ask. One of the things I did was, I remember, you know, I mean, I had written Royal Arch, I'd written Cinema Symbolism, and I did Cinema Symbolism too. And I wanted to do this work of fiction. And the one thing that, you know, that I did, which I would highly recommend, is take a look at other fiction writers, see how they do it. I looked at some of the works of, because it's interesting, because what you're going to find out, it's very different. You take a look at someone like Stephen King, for instance. That's sort of kind of like the template that I followed. I took a look at J.K. Rowling with the Harry Potter stories. I thought she did something that I thought she did something very well in her stories that I tried to do in mine, was she kept the story moving. She had a very fast flow to her stories, and I liked that. I thought that was good. There wasn't any real stagnation with it. But then what's interesting is you take a look at that, and that gives you a good idea of, you know, okay, you know, now I know, you know, how to use this here and how to create dialogue and intro and exit. But what's interesting is you read books by people like, you know, J.R. Tolkien, let's say, or H.P. Lovecraft. They do things differently back then. And part of the reason why is, I mean, their descriptions sometimes can be very lengthy. Like Bram Stoker, for instance, in Dracula. I mean, in Dracula, I believe there's 5 descriptions of Abraham Van Helsing. You can't do that today. In the fast-paced world of Twitter and social media, and you know, where a post has to be condensed and, you know, read real quickly, you know, you're just going to lose your audience if you describe someone 5 times in a novel. You just can't do it anymore. So I bore that all in mind, and I took all that in. I remember, you know, when I was doing this, when I first started doing it, I started writing in. It was a little clunky and, you know, a little over the top at some points, and some of it was a little too repetitious. And I remember I had put it down for about 6 months, and in that 6-month time frame, I started looking more and more at these, some of these other authors, and you know, just to see how they did. And I remember when I came back to it, I thought, oh yeah, I mean, I got to cut this out, and this can go here, and this is a little too much here, and this is, you know, this is kind of repeating what I did a little earlier. I don't need all this. So, you know, if you're thinking about writing fiction, what I would recommend, one of the things you could do, is take a look at other people, and, you know, take a look at other people. I mean, like, and there were some people I read that I wasn't really fond of. You know, I remember flipping through one of the 50 Shades of Grey book, and that's written in the first person. You know, that's I did this, you know, and this happened to me, that I didn't want to do. So I stayed away from that. So, yeah, I looked at other fiction writers, and I thought, okay, well, this is the way it's done. This is the way it's done. And it certainly helped me out when I was doing a
novel. Well, you say you got the idea in a dream. How much of it did you get in the dream?
Oh, I would say quite a lot of it. I got most of the characters in a dream. I got some dialogue in a dream. I've got characters' names, the overall template, the mystery in it, the settings were there. Certainly, you know, not everything was. There was some things I changed. It was in Highgate, and that was a place I had visited years ago when I was a student at Oxford University. I don't know why I wound up there, but I visiting Highgate Cemetery. It's a real place, It's north of London in where else but Highgate, and it's a ancient, well, not ancient, but it's a very old, and it goes back to Victorian times, overgrown cemetery. It's fallen into total disrepair. It's very Gothic. It has all this overgrown architecture, you know, covered in ivy, and you know, it's just, you know, you can go online and Google it, and you know, you're gonna see it. I mean, it just, it's really leaves an impression on you if you ever visit it. But take a look at the pictures online. It's just a fascinating place to visit. Very, very spiritual, very ghostly. You know, you really feel like you're almost like in a living, breathing cemetery almost. And that's where the dream was. And then we had the characters, of course, and they were all in there. There was a couple characters I changed from the dream to the novel that I just couldn't write. I mean, it just came off ham-handed. There was a, in the dream, there was a love interest of one of the characters that did not work out at all. It was terrible to write. It read like a bad romance novel. I did not like it. And this character, if you read the book or the novel, this became the Ryan Lowry character, the dwarf figure. This character morphed into him. So that was something that I took license with. But overall, I mean, that was pretty much it. And you know, I remember waking up and just kind of being taken by it. And thinking to myself, you know, well, let me just start making notes on this. And of course, as I was writing it, I remember in the dream, it was almost somewhat of a bit of a, some of it was told in flashback. I remember the dream actually opened, when I had the dream actually opened in the second half of the movie, where the one author who was loosely based on me was visiting Highgate Cemetery with the Freighter Ali character. And some of it was going backwards. So that was the dream, and that was the, you know, I didn't want to write it like that. I certainly didn't want to write it in a flashback. I wanted to keep the storyline 100% linear moving forward. But that was it, and I was real happy with the way it came out. I really enjoyed writing it. It was certainly a break. You know, I'll just wrap up by saying it was certainly a break from the other three books, you know, where you're doing all this research and footnoting and watching movies and watching scenes in movies, you know, 20, 30 times and over again. I mean, it was really nice to be able to create and not have to worry about, you know, okay, who said what on what page or who said what in what movie and footnoting or any of that. That was a very nice break for me.
Well, now also, you know, this is about a group of women that creates a coven and, you know, makes a pact with the devil. Now it wasn't the devil, but it was a lower echelon devil. I mean, they do summon the devil and make a pact with it. And, the ceremonies they go through, you know, you had mentioned are authentic. Where did you find them?
Right. The devil actually is not actually a pact with the devil. It is actually with a very high ranking demon of hell named Lucifuge Rofakal. That is a real demon, according to many ancient grimoires. You can look him up. You'll find, you know, sketches of what this demon purports to look like. He's one of the more vicious particular demons. His name actually means he who flees the light, where you have someone like he who is the light bearer. So Lucifuge Rofakal has a very dark figure. The rituals that you read in the story that I used are authentic. I condensed them to a certain extent, and I did tweak them, of course, to fit the story. But those are authentic rituals. They come out of grimoires, which are spell books. I believe some of the ones I used in crafting the story were rituals from the Grand Grimoire, Ars Goetia. Those were the two biggies that I used. The Key of Solomon as well, I think was in there. Those spells, those conjurations, now they were shortened. You know, like I said, I did tweak them, you know, for the sake of the story. I mean, I didn't want them to be, you know, 7 pages long or anything like that. I did condense it, but I wanted you to get the feel for what you were reading was very ancient. You know, I mean, they come out of, you know, the Renaissance and going back to medieval and, you know, supposedly coming out of ancient Israel and Chaldea and the Middle East. So, you know, I left the language the same in them as they appear in the grimoire. And those are actual summoning rituals that you're reading. That's absolutely true.
I was, you know, blown away. And, you know, the other reason I would hope you would tweak them is so nobody could actually replicate them.
Oh yeah, that had occurred to me. I didn't want people reading them and have actually a demon appearing in front of them. Good grief. Those conjurations are all real though. I mean, you can purchase. I mean, I don't want to encourage anyone, but certainly these grimoires, you know, they're modern day renditions of them. But you could certainly purchase Ars Goetia and a lot of these grimoires right off of Amazon. And they will give you the spells and the incantations and the sigils on, you know, what to do to, you know, summon a demonic principality, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Well, now you also left, I mean, you did kind of leave it a little bit hanging in the book because you didn't go into what the mirror actually was, you know, the portal of the mirror. And I would assume that that's going to be in the next book.
Right. There's actually, you know, there's two of them, and you get an idea of what this thing is in the novel. You know, and this will be more explained in the second one. But yeah, you get an idea of what this thing was. And, you know, how the demon was using it and things like that. This is definitely something that I'm continuing to explore. I didn't want to leave, I didn't want, you know, to lock down everything in the story. I wanted some things to be somewhat, you know, speculative. I wanted the reader to perhaps use their imagination on it and think, you know, well, what could this be or what could that be? Or, you know, have questions about it. I didn't want to have everything completely, you know, pinned down to the ground. But this is certainly something that I definitely tend to explore more in the second book and also in some of the prequels I'm writing.
Well, I have to admit, I read a lot. I read sometimes as many as 3 or 4 books a week. So, but yours was fun to read. It was a joy to be able to go on a journey and, you know, things up and, you know, I have to admit, I also in reading it was looking for archetypes. So because you find them in other books and movies. Did you intentionally put any in, or did you find that some turned up on their own?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say archetypes, but there's obviously clearly characters that I was drawing on. I mean, I kind of hinted at it in some of the dialogue and just some of the themes. I mean, clearly what I thought was interesting, I thought a lot of the women in it were anti-heroes. And I like that aspect of it. And I definitely incorporated on purpose some dark humor and some comedy. That was, you know, I did not want this book to be joyless. I mean, I wanted it to be in the end fun to read. I mean, I wanted you to, you know, to have an entertaining experience. I didn't want this thing to be a downer. You know, that this was nothing but, you know, a total downer when you were reading it. So. I mean, clearly the Rob and Amir characters, I mean, are you know what I would call sort of, you know, Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson analogs almost. The women, I kind of viewed them as anti-heroes. For me, it was always trying to get one to outdo the other almost. And one of my favorite characters in it was the Belinda character. I just kind of viewed her as like a wrecking ball almost, you know, who, you know, these women kind of thought they were, you know, who are into hardcore stuff. And she comes along and kind of, you know, is even more hardcore than they are. And then I like the Sophie character as well, because I thought that was really someone who I thought had to be in there. And there was a character like it in the dream. She got morphed around a little bit. I don't want to give too much away, but I really like the Sophie character because I thought she, you know, you have this whole thing with the witches and the pact, and she comes along and says, this is, who cares about any of this anyway? You know, this is petty to me. You know, and I thought that kind of, you know, took everything back a little bit. And you know, I thought it was like a challenge, you know, very, very like a rivalry going on that was good. I didn't want at any time to have this book. I mean, I think it's serious and I think it's entertaining and I do think it gets scary and can be morbid and certainly erotic. But I was a little afraid that, if there was, you know, no humor in it or some of these characters wanted it, it was just going to take itself too seriously. I didn't think it was going to work on certain levels. I think it works the way it does right now, you know, as the way it is. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, it's funny because I think there are archetypes in there, but it's almost like varying levels of the same archetype. And that would be, you know, what I would call like the anti-hero. You know, sort of like the Hannibal Lecter character, the character you love to hate almost, that you're secretly rooting for. Those I think pop up if anything more and more in the novel. I don't know if I'd go to say there was any hero. I guess Robin Amir would come closest to it, but certainly even they're flawed. And you know, I wanted to convey that in the story.
No, it was it was definitely interesting. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it, and I kept thinking, huh, you know, 32nd degree Mason into, you know, and you brought in the Illuminati and Masonry,
sure,
and everything. And it just, I guess, you know, I was surprised that it was about covens and everything else, although I love reading about this stuff. So, you know, it made it even more enjoyable for me to read. So, but it was a good read. And,
well, thank you.
Yeah, and I did enjoy it. And in many ways, it was more fun to read than the other books. I mean, I learned from the other books, but I learned from this one too. I mean, you obviously were in locations that you knew, so you were describing,
sure,
them beautifully, and the characters were very well developed. So it was fun to read, and I am looking forward to the next one.
Well, thank you, Barbara. I'll just elaborate on that a little bit. Some of the locations, a lot of them are real, not all of them are, but certainly, you know, places like Freemasons Hall in London is real, the Ten Bells is real, Mother's Bar and Grill here in Baltimore is certainly real, a bar that I frequent from time to time, the Maryland Historical Society, certainly Highgate Cemetery, these were all real venues. And I thought that, you know, the one thing I liked, and I kind of found this out when I was writing fiction, is when you're doing it and you know, the people are drinking or smoking, you want to give them real products. It grounds it in reality. If you start making up product names or something, it becomes a little far-fetched or something. Now, if your story takes place on another planet or another dimension, that's another issue. But if you're setting it in this reality, it helps ground it. At least I think it did. And the one thing that was really critical with me with writing this was, and this came from my research from college, was, you know, witchcraft is such a nebulous word. It's a broad meaning word. It can have numerous meanings. And the story I really was trying to stay away from was about people who, you know, kind of cast spells on their neighbors or made love potions or, you know, things like that. That really held little interest for me. The one thing that was always prevalent with witchcraft, especially in the Middle Ages, was the idea of, and I'm not saying this to sound cliched, but was the pact with the devil, or the interaction with the demon. This is where the witch got her energy from, which got her power from, was this diabolical contract she had signed. And if you read books about the history of witchcraft, and certainly these books are still available, the ones I would recommend, or at least, you know, I mean, there's plenty of books on witchcraft. There's a Princeton professor named Jeffrey Burton Russell who wrote A History of the Devil, and he also wrote a book on witchcraft. I believe it's called The History of Witchcraft. And he gets into this, and he essentially says, and there's another author named Carlos Ginzburg, and he wrote a book called The Night Battles, which is an interesting read. These guys essentially say that if the woman or the witch or the warlock, if that contract with the devil was absent, then it's really not witchcraft. The contract with the devil is critical for it to be quote unquote witchcraft, or for the person to be a quote unquote witch. Without that, it's essentially a form of midwifery or agrarian worship. So I wanted to, you know, really drive that home when I was writing the story. And when I was doing it, I was on another show talking about this, and I'll just mention it briefly here. There were two movies that I would say were very influential on me when I was writing this. And certainly, you know, I remember replaying them in my head when I was writing it. And the first one was a movie from the 1960s called Mask of the Red Death. It was put out by Roger Corman. It's an AIP picture. It stars Vincent Price and Hazel Court. And this was the movie where, this is, of course, loosely based on Edgar Allan Poe's story, where the devil worshippers, the Satanists, was the upper, you know, the oligarchy, the upper class. This was the religion of the aristocracy. You know, I didn't want to portray the devil worshippers in the story as, you know, people running around killing animals, you know, or spray painting things on walls. You know, I wanted to make it this, you know, sort of, you know, very erotic, upper echelon religion of the, you know, upper class, essentially. You know, this was nothing to be trifled with. And that's what was in The Mask of the Red Death. So I drew that from that. And then there was another movie that came out in the early 20s, which is very erotic and very dark for the time. It's called Haxan. It's a silent movie. And again, it deals with witches and devils and Sabbats and things like that. But it's very dark and very erotic. And these were the, sort of the two movies that I just had playing in my mind that I was drawing inspiration from when I was writing this. So, you know, yeah, I mean, I was real happy with the way it came out, and it's out now. You can buy it on Kindle or paperback. And like I said, I'm working on the sequel and some prequel stories as well. So we'll see what happens.
One question. Now, I know I have a number of friends who are pagan. And, you know, they celebrate the same holidays as, quote unquote, witches do, and they do have covens. What is the difference between those who are pagan and those who are evil demon worshippers?
Right. Well, that's just it. I mean, a pagan, you know, will just worship, you know, God, you know, gods or the pagan gods, you know, and celebrate Christmas as the solstice, things like that. I mean, you know, there's a thing out there called the Church of Satan, which is formed by a guy named Anton LaVey. Mm-hmm. And I got into it a little bit because he has rituals and he has some interesting books, and he's an interesting read. He has a book called The Satanic Rituals and the Satanic Bible. When I tell people about this and when I do interviews, this is his invention. You know, this is just LaVey being LaVey. The Church of Satan, many people will be surprised to hear this, actually don't believe in the devil, and they don't believe in God. They don't believe in any hereafter whatsoever. They believe they're almost like a sex pagan cult. And that's why I bring them up in response to your question is they don't believe in any hereafter or any consciousness after death. The LaVey Satanist believes that this time and now that you're here is here and it. This is it. So while you're here, you engage in any depravity or orgy or, you know, perverse sexual pleasure that you wish to engage in, because there's nothing else after it. So while you're here, you do it, you know, you do whatever you want. Now, you don't hurt other people, but as long as you have consenting adults, whatever your sexual hangup is, this should be explored. It's basically a sex pagan cult. And it's not where, you know, like in the pact with the devil. I mean, there is an erotic element of that, because that is part of witchcraft also. I wanted it to be, you know, Satanists that were in line with the devil, that were very evil, that were evil doers, and that were worshiping these dark entities, these dark forces. I mean, they weren't praying to, you know, Diana or Mercury or Zeus or anything like that. Because you do have this over history, this twining, and this is, you know, we talked about earlier with witches. I mean, you know, if you eliminate the pact with the demon, you're essentially into pagan agrarianism. And you can read Jeffrey Burton Russell on this. I mean, that was bad also. I mean, don't get me wrong. The secular authorities didn't like that either. But I mean, they wanted to, you know, if you were being hung, you know, or burned at the stake, they wanted to find, you know, the contract in blood that you had signed with the devil, the demonic, you know, forces that you were in line with, you know, your contract, your grimoires, you know, your black cat, your familiar, that's what they were into. If that was absent, then you were essentially into like a midwife, you know, or a pagan of some kind. Now, they didn't like that either, but that technically wasn't the hardcore satanic witch that, you know, these guys are talking about. And if you read the books on it, I mean, you know, they all go through this guide. You read even the witch hunting guides like Compendium Maleficarum, the Witch's Hammer, things like that. They all get in that and they say, you know, well, number one, it, you know, has to be, you know, a person who's a non-Christian or something like that. But it says, you know, contract with the demon, contract with the devil, you know, that is highlighted. And, you know, this has to be there for this person to be a witch. if that's not there, again, it's just, you know, like you said, like a pagan cult. And it is separate. Now, of course, there is overlap, of course, but it is separate. And I kind of shied away from that when I was writing the story.
There was one part of it that I was, I wanted to ask you about. At one point, they were killing babies.
Right.
And is that actually something that came from you, or is that something that they actually did? I mean, they were doing it for a specific purpose.
Right. No, that is in the literature. That the killing of infant can generate something that is mentioned in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll get into it. It's, you know, I mean, you know, this is part of witchcraft, that, you know, the baby fat and the killing of an infant can be used to generate flying ointment. This is something that was explored in a movie actually recently. It's a very dark movie. It's called The Witch, of all things. And it is about, it takes place in Puritan New England. And it is about a very devout, you know, Puritan family who, you know, is at odds with the church. They don't think they're Christian enough, so they go out into the wilderness to practice this very devout form of Christianity. And living off in the woods is a witch who starts really tormenting them. And I don't want to give it away. I think the movie came out in 2015. I highly recommend the movie. It's very good. The dialogue is done in Old English, though. They speak Old English, you know, so you got to watch it maybe once or twice, a couple times, to be able to really pick up the dialogue. But it's very good. The devil, Lucifer, actually turns up at the end of the movie. And again, this is the whole idea of the witch being in league with the demon. I incorporated that in there. And I wanted to, you know, hammer home the idea that these women were evildoers. I mean, you know, that this, like I said, I mean, it's in there a little bit, but I didn't want this to be, you know, these women, you know, making love potions or doing stuff like that. I mean, I wanted to convey that these were, you know, really, you know, malignant people engaging in a really dangerous and demonic form of witchcraft here.
I have to admit, though, the concept of thinking of modern day women flying on broomsticks, I had to chuckle.
Yeah, I had to put that in there just because that's such archetypal imagery with witches. I just loved it in there. And it's a plot device because it actually turns up, but of course no one believes it anyway.
Yeah.
And I just thought it worked with great effect. And there was scenes in it at the end where, I mean, you know, I do have them in the archetypal witch's clothing. That was certainly done by me. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to convey that imagery as well. The idea of the witch in the pointed conical hat, you know, the Margaret Hamilton witch from The Wizard of Oz. I just had that archetypal imagery in my head, and I just had to put it in there. And there was also an idea in the book with the whole idea with the, you know, a lot of us, oh, this is all total nonsense. You can't do it anyway. This is a wives' tale. And of course, you know, it's learned in the story that you actually can do it. So I had that in there as well, that, you know, that there was some witches who didn't believe it in any way and didn't want any part of it. It was like a conflict almost, you know, that's a waste of time, you know, who does it, but, you know, that these women were doing this. And I wanted to be something that, you know, incorporated this diabolical element in order to do it. I just didn't want to be like, oh, a snap of the finger and, you know, you could fly around. There had to be this, thing that they had to acquire in order to do it that was very diabolical. And I thought it worked for great effect.
Oh, yeah. They took it so casually. It was just, you know, like, oh, we need to get more.
Right, exactly.
But I mean, the murder at the end surprised me. And I won't mention who it was. But also in the head of each chapter, you gave references to movies that flowed or had something similar to do with the plot?
Yeah, I always this is something I do in all my books. I always start the chapter with quotes. They have meaning to different parts of it. I kind of leave this to, this is sort of a mystery. I leave this to the reader to try to figure out. I don't want to get too specific, but I can tell you that in all my books, there are hidden codes and things like that going on inside them. I mentioned this at the end of the at the end of the chapter on in Cinema Symbolism too. I think I mentioned it at the end of the introduction that there are hidden meanings in the books, and I used quotes in there that set up the chapter that had meanings for future chapters that look back. The quotes are selected by me personally. They're not random. I don't pull them out of a hat or anything. So yeah, when you're reading my books, always make sure you read the little quotes at the beginning of each chapter. They spread enlightenment, perhaps ask a question, perhaps plant something in your subconscious mind. That's what I'm going for here.
Yeah, no, it was a good read. There is no doubt about it. And and I do look forward to the next one. I mean, it's so unusual to have to not think when I read your stuff. So,
well, no, I tried to, when I was writing it, I tried to have it sort of flowing. I didn't want to write, you know, a 500 page novel. I had no interest in that. I wanted it, you know, to come in under 400. I wanted it to be, you know, readable. You know, I didn't want my first novel to be some sort of, you know, over the top 800 page thing or something like that. With the other books, I don't mind doing it. But I wanted this to flow. I wanted it to be interesting. I wanted it to have comedy. I wanted to have archetypal imagery in it. And I wanted not everything to be uniform. I wanted there to be, you know, disagreement amongst, you know, some of the witches and some of the people that was going on as to what was going on. I left things, certain things open-ended. To, you know, have the reader use their imagination. I didn't want everything locked down. You know, that was done on purpose by me. And, you know, I mean, there it was. I mean, that was the dream. That's the story. And I was real happy with the way it came out. And, yeah, I mean, there's the Pact with the Devil. And like I said, I'm actually working on its sequel right now. I'm outlining that. And I'm doing a series of stories called Tales of the Black Flame. I mean, of course, that's the name of the witches coming in. And these are going to be like backstories about some of the characters. And I've started on, it's funny you actually mentioned the mirror, because the mirror is the focus point of the backstory on the first one of these. That's in the works. And of course, I've started Cinema Symbolism 3, and I've got another book on Freemasonry. And then there's another project that I'm working on. And I think I've mentioned this the last time I was on, or maybe not. But I can't talk about this. I'm bound by a non-disclosure agreement on. But I'm working on like five books at once right now, like kind of flipping between them. So yeah, a lot going on right now. And you know, I'll tell you and the audience, and certainly you can ask questions if you want to or not. I was actually just interviewed here a week ago at the Scottish Rite Temple by Japanese television. I'm going to be part of a documentary that's airing over the summer on NHK television. That's Japan's BBC. It goes internationally. I don't know if your cable company has NHK, but it's about Albert Einstein's brain. And years ago, I used to collect historical artifacts, and I actually tried. A lot of people may not be aware of this. Albert Einstein's brain was dissected and was taken out of his head when he died, and this eccentric doctor owned it. And he would tease people to try to buy it. I tried to buy a piece, and this was years ago. And I wrote letters to him. The guy's name was Dr. Harvey, and he had the brain. He had put some of it on slides, and he had other parts in a jar. And I wrote letters, a string of letters to him, and I was surprised to learn. I was contacted. This was back in like 1993. I sent these letters to him. And he phoned me. He was interested in selling me a piece. He ultimately backed out. I don't think he sold any to anybody. But anyway, I was contacted by these Japanese television company. And apparently these letters that I wrote are in like the National Archives or something, as like the Sullivan Harvey correspondences. And apparently it's a big deal. I had no idea. So they interviewed me. I was at the Scottish Rite Temple. And they interviewed me for like 3 hours on this.
Wow.
And yeah, this is going to air over the summer. So I'm going to be on TV in Japan. So that was really an interesting thing. So a lot going on right now.
Well, now Einstein's brain, as I recall, I know it was taken out when he died. And
right.
I know that he had deeper indentations than most in his brain.
Well, I don't know about that. Cause Harvey, when he took the brain out, his whole purpose was he wanted to examine it to see if there was any physical differences. And I think he said there weren't any, he said it was just looked like a normal brain. But I have to go look at that. But I know he put some on slides. He put small pieces on slides, and then the other he kept in a jar, and he kept it like in his closet. I mean, he was an eccentric guy. And they also took I think he took his eyeballs also, and they kept them in a glass jar. And when I was being interviewed about this, my impression of Harvey was, I think, you know, I remember talking to him on the phone, and he was like, oh, yeah, I'll sell you a piece. And, you know, I mean, I was telling him, you know, this wasn't going to be part of a carnival or a freak show. This was just going into a historical collection. But I got the impression he backed out at the end. He never went through with it. And I think that there was always this thing with him that I don't think he had permission to take the brain. I don't think he had legal title to it. So if that was the case, you know, he could technically get in trouble, you know, legally selling something that he didn't have the right to own. So at any rate, I don't know. I mean, this was years ago, Barbara. This was like in 1993, but this Japanese company, they're doing a whole documentary on it. This quest for Albert Einstein's brain, apparently, they told me that apparently pieces are being sold on the black market for loads of money. Apparently when Harvey died, like 200 slides were missing. They don't know where they are. They actually had to get permission from me to go to the National Archives. I believe it's not the National Archives. I believe it's like the National Institute of Medicine and Health, where my letters are, to film the letters to see them. So I had to talk to one of the curators down there to give this Japanese production company permission to see that. And then it was about a week ago, I met them at the Scottish Rite Temple here in Baltimore, and they interviewed me for like 2 hours about the brain and talking with Harvey and things like that. So yeah, this is going to be in a big time documentary coming up this summer. So
really good. Was Einstein a Mason?
No, he was not. You know, just known for, you know, introducing the world to the atomic age, but he was not a Freemason. And when they spoke to me, they wanted a place to film, and I've done other interviews there. So yeah, we went to the temple, and yeah, I mean, they filmed me for like 2 hours. So it's a whole interview. It's like going to be, you know, like a History Channel type thing.
That's really cool.
yeah. I mean, I was floored. I mean, this started coming into place in October of last year. I got a real long email from them, and they introduced themselves. And, you know, I started corresponding with them, and they said, you know, can we talk to you about this? And I said, sure. I said, you know, this was many moons ago now. I said, I don't really collect historical artifacts anymore. I used to, but I haven't really done it in about 10 years. I have a couple pieces still hanging around, but, you know, not anything like I used to. And they just started talking to me and picking my brain about it. And they sent me, I think, a questionnaire, about 20 questions, which I answered. And then it was around, I think, the end of December or beginning of January, I got an email from them saying, you know, what does February look like for you? And I said, well, you know, I'm fine. I'll work with you. And they said, well, if we came to Baltimore, would you consent to an interview? I mean, could we film you a whole thing? I said, sure. The next thing, they said, this is still up in the air. And the next thing I know, they said, you know, we want to come and film you on February, I think it was the 11th or something. And, show up, you know, wear a suit, and, you know, we're going to, you know, I mean, they came in. I mean, the woman who I was talking to was multilingual. She could speak English and Japan. She was coming in from California. The three people, the production guy and the camera crew, these guys were all flying in from Tokyo. I mean, they didn't speak a word of English. And I'm talking to them, and she's translating and doing all this. So yeah, I mean, it was quite an experience, to say the least. I loved it.
Is it going to be in English or Japanese?
Well, my interview was in English. She interviewed me in English, but I suspect if it's airing in Japan, they're going to put Japanese subtitles under it, I would think. But I mean, you know, I don't think they're going to dub my voice or anything like that. You know, I mean, I don't think so. My understanding was, I mean, it'll be in English, you know, and probably they'll subcaption my answers, you know, in the Japanese language. That was my understanding of it.
Wow. Well, that is exciting.
Yeah. I mean, I was thrilled. And, you know, this it's interesting. I don't want to go too far with this. Because I am bound by a non-confidentiality agreement, but, This other project that I'm working on that I can't talk about is actually somewhat interrelated with this in a little bit of a circuitous way. But I'm hoping in the next couple months to be able to come more public with this, because this is something that's very special, and this is something that's really going to be interesting. And I think that, you know, I certainly would have no problem doing an interview about it. But unfortunately, Barbara, right now, you know, I'm bound by a non-disclosure agreement, so I can't talk about that right now.
Okay. Well, the time will come when you can, and happily, you know, I have a couple questions. What books are you hitting in Cinema Symbolism 3?
Right. I finally got around one of the chapters that I just got done writing. It's funny you mentioned, because I got to go back and take a look at it. One of the movies that it came out in the fall, and I finally saw it, and I mean, my goodness gracious, is Darren Aronofsky's Mother. Boy, oh boy. I mean, what a symbolic, I mean, that whole movie is nothing but symbolic. So that is one. I've already written the chapter on that. I mean, that's one when, as soon as you start watching it, you're like, you know, just scribbling down notes on that thing. So Mother will be in there. We're going to talk about, some of the new Star Wars movies that have come out. I haven't seen Last Jedi yet, but I've seen Rogue One, and I've seen the episode seven, The Force Awakens. Mm-hmm. There's some interesting stuff going on in that, especially in Episode Seven. I suspect The Last Jedi, you know, is going to be esoteric, but I haven't seen it yet. So we're going to do the Star Wars again. We're going to revisit that. I'm going to do some more of the David Lynch movies that I couldn't watch, that I couldn't take on in Cinema Symbolism 2. I'm going to finally get around to doing Twin Peaks, you know, the first series, Fire Walk With Me, and this new series that's come out. I haven't seen the new series yet, but that's something I'm going to take on. You know, Lynch's movies are all over the place, you know, and you know, Eraserhead, and the one with Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern, Wild at Heart. I'm going to take a look at that one again. Mm-hmm. So we're going to do more David Lynch. We're going to do some more Walt Disney pictures. We're going to do some of the darker Disney stuff, you know, like, you know, Something Wicked This Way Comes, and what's it, The Black Cauldron. We're going to take a look at those. The Red Shoes, that was a movie that came out in 1948. That has some interesting symbolism going on in it as well. That's a movie I want to, you know, incorporate. I'm going to do a chapter in this book called Gnostic Hollywood. And what I'm going to do is, I mean, Gnosticism, this is something I've, you know, hit on in all my books. I'm going to take on this slate of Gnostic movies. And these are movies that I haven't covered in other books that are essentially, you know, quintessentially Gnostic. I'm going to, of course, temporarily just get into, you know, like an introduction with like some of the movies like The Matrix and The Truman Show, things like that. But we're going to do movies like Dark City, Snowpiercer, Metropolis, Fritz Lang. These are decidedly Gnostic films. So we're going to do a whole chapter on that. So yeah, that's just, you know, to whet your appetite for Cinema Symbolism 3. I've already begun writing it. I've begun outlining it. And like I said, I just got done watching this Darren Aronofsky movie called Mother. And my goodness gracious, loads of symbolism going on in that thing. Loads of.
Well, my vote is still for Avatar and Interstellar.
Yeah, I have actually those in my notes to take a look at. I have not watched them yet, but I have them in the book to take a look at. And, you know, that'll be definitely be something I take a look at, and we'll see what's up with them.
Yeah, because, you know, when I watched both of them, I mean, even down to with Avatar, the planet they go to is called Pandora.
Right.
So, you know, and there's a tree of life there, and there's all sorts of stuff. And Interstellar works with string theory.
And, oh, okay.
And it's among other things. So they're both. When I saw both of them, all I could think of was, oh God, Robert has to see these.
Yeah, I remember you telling me, and I actually have them in my notes to take a look at. So yeah, absolutely. Those were ones that I was planning on doing. There's some other ones in there as well. I just can't recall off the top of my head. But no, I've got a whole slate for Cinema Symbolism 3.
Wow. Well, you know, happily, you know, Hollywood is never going to run out of movies for you to see. I don't know if the 50 Shades of Grey would enter into that at all.
But I haven't seen any of those. I haven't seen any of those. And I don't know. You know, again, it's one of those things, Barbara, when you start writing this and you start doing movies, the one thing that immediately starts to happen is you say to yourself, oh, I can't incorporate all the stuff in there. You know, I'll have to do it in Cinema Symbolism 4. This happened in the first book. This happened in the second book. I mean, there were still things I was planning on taking on that I had to cut out. I mean, when I did Cinema Symbolism, I was going to do the David Lynch stuff and put in the first movie book. I was going to do the Walt Disney stuff, and there was just no way. I mean, there was just no way, no how. So I did it in the second book, and then when I was doing Cinema Symbolism 2, I wanted to do the Twin Peaks, and then I was just like, there's no way. I mean, this book is already going to be, you know, whatever it is, 660 or something. If I do Twin Peaks, you know, you're talking easily another, you know, 40 pages at least. I mean, there's no way. So, you know, inevitably what's going to happen is I'm going to start writing Cinema Symbolism 3, and all the, you know, I'm going to be saying to myself, well, this is going to be Cinema Symbolism 4. I have no doubt of that.
I think what I appreciated most about Cinema Symbolism 2 was that you took the time to write a small critique of each of the movies, so that if someone had not seen the movie, they at least got an idea of what it was about, so that they understood where you were going with your interpretations.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I always, you know, it's one of those things. I always try to balance that out. Someone just gave me a negative review on this, on the first cinema book. They said, oh, well, this guy describes everything in Star Wars. Well, you're damn right I do. You know, if the story is itself a symbol, you know, the monomyth, you have to have that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, exactly. But, you know, some people don't like it, but that's the way of the world. There's nothing you can do about it. But yeah, I mean, if the story is, you know, is following the monomyth, you know, the Campbell's hero's journey, I mean, and the story is itself the symbol. Yeah, you got to talk about it. You got to talk about what's going on in it. Otherwise, you can't dissect it. You can't analyze it. So, yeah, I mean, when I'm doing this, I try to balance it out with, you know, I don't want to write a book about, you know, movie synopsis. But on the other hand, you know, it's always sitting in the back of my head. Well, you know, if the person's never seen the movie, it's good to maybe give them some idea of what this movie is about. But it is a fine line to walk. I try to do it, but, you know, I don't want to write nothing but movie synopses. But I tend to agree with you, Barbara, that, you know, if a person's never seen the movie and the movie is the storyline is of itself symbolic, you kind of have to have it.
Well, I'm lucky in that in many cases, I would say in almost 75%, maybe 80% of the movies that you have reviewed, if there was a book prior to it, I've read the book and seen the movie. So
right.
it really is. It gives me another view to the whole thing, because sometimes the movie doesn't necessarily follow where the book went.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, the director, you know, gets hold of the story and changes it around completely. I think the one that I constantly am going back to is The Shining, where Kubrick just turned this thing into an ode to repetition, which isn't in the novel at all. You know, and kind of left the ghost story out, and King didn't like it. But you know, Kubrick just turned this thing into this symbolic masterpiece that goes by a lot of people. And I don't think King fully understood what he was doing with it. But you know, The Shining is just so many underlying things going on, and it's just a fascinating study. But you know, then you get into stuff like the James Bond stories, where you know they're doing, you will find in the story the hermetic influence, you know, the male and female, the unification, you know, the archetypal, you know, vicious evil, you know villain. This is all good stuff, but it's just again at the level, a lot of it just revolves around levels of sophistication of the author and of the film director. Some guys are much more apt and much more, you know, tuned into this stuff than Kubrick with The Shining, where you won't find the symbolism in the novel. If you get around to watching it, I the next time I come on, take a look at the Darren Aronofsky movie Mother. You should probably, you know, that's really interesting symbolically. Some of it's a little overt. You probably, you know, some of it's, he doesn't go out of the way. The whole movie is symbolic. It's not meant to be taken literally. And some of it, you know, kind of does jump off the page as to what he's going for. But he does hide some unique things in there. And you know, that's really the, out of all the movies I've seen lately, by far and away, that's the most symbolic one that I would say, if you really want to watch a symbolic movie, take a look at Mother with Jennifer Lawrence and Javier Bardem. Fascinating movie.
Wow. Well, you definitely have some that you've just taken to pieces. But what fascinates me is Walt Disney. Now, I know with a lot of these other movies, you know, The Shining and some of the deeper ones. I mean, yeah, of course you're going to find the symbolism, but Walt Disney.
Yeah, well, they you know, a lot of the fairy tales and things like that are, you know, I mean, they repeat themselves. It's the same story. It's archetypal imagery, the male and the female, you know, the villainous, you know, the odious mother. You'll find the odious father in a lot of Western movies. You know, it has to do with a lot of those movies have to do with themes coming out of the Counter-Reformation and the Enlightenment. Very well hidden. Walt Disney, unfortunately, gets a bad rap for a lot of this. These stories predate Walt Disney. But, you know, then you watch something like The Lion King, which is completely symbolic. Loads of solar imagery going on in that. Very archetypal. It actually also borrows from William Shakespeare's Hamlet. And, you know, you look at it and people say, oh, you know, why is this symbolism? Why do these guys do it? Well, you take a look at The Lion King. I mean, this was a movie that just appealed to everybody. I mean, I was like 22, 23. I mean, there were people my age going to see a Walt Disney, you know, animated movie. I mean, you know, I'm like, you know, dudes, you know, I remember being in college, I think at the time, I'm like, you know, come on, you know, I mean, we outgrew this stuff years ago. And they're like, oh, no, man, this is a great movie. You know, you got to check it out. You know, and it is. I mean, and, you know, you're dealing with themes of William Shakespeare. You're dealing with solar iconography. I mean, that movie came out in 1994. That was the second highest grossing movie in 1994 behind Forrest Gump. So, you know, these guys know what they're doing with this stuff. And, you know, yeah, Walt Disney, you know, I wanted to take on more Walt Disney movies when I was writing Cinema Symbolism 2. But again, I just ran out of time and space. But no, I'm going to visit Walt Disney. And yeah, you'll definitely, you know, find some interesting things going on inside his movies. I don't dispute that.
Now, I read someplace, I have a ton of material on you, so it's hard to tell exactly where it is. And it's all over my desktop here. So Fantasia.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was one that I took on in Cinema Symbolism 2. This gets a bad rap. There's a lot of stuff going on. People think this has to do with mind control and stuff like that. I mean, I don't see any of it. And this is, I mean, I think it's people seeing things that aren't there. And this gets this has an incredibly bad rap to it for the final vignette, the Night on Bald Mountain, you know, part where it's, you know, you know, with the demon and things like that. What people don't realize is it's very Manichaean. It's light versus darkness, because people stop with the Night on Bald Mountain, but it's actually Ave Maria also.
Yeah.
And the sun comes up and it's very Christian, and the monks go into the temple and the darkness is defeated. And people say, oh, this is Walt Disney lionizing, you know, demons and devil worship. Well, keep watching it. I mean, it's just light versus dark. It's good versus evil. I mean, there's nothing really sinister about it. I like the Sorcerer's Apprentice as well. That's a good one. You know, with the, you know, you have, you know, certainly Mickey Mouse experimenting with Kabbalah and alchemy, transforming the little broomsticks into people, turning them into, you know, Kabbalistic golems. You have the guy, the wizard's name. What is it? It's something like, I forget what it is, but it's Disney spelled backwards. It's the wizard's name. It's Disney backwards. So you can check that out. But you know, I get into Fantasia, and it's a great piece of artwork. I mean, I really like watching that, you know, set to the classical music and things like that. So you know, this was something that I got into in Cinema Symbolism too. So you know, and I got into, you know, some of the more archetypal you know, Disney movies. I did Snow White, I did Cinderella, I did Sleeping Beauty. Those are all pretty much the same story, just with some alternating characters in them. And then I got into Maleficent, which is interesting. That also has, that was sort of like the sequel kind of revision of Sleeping Beauty with Angelina Jolie.
That was a great movie.
Yeah, I like that too. I have that here on a Blu-ray disc. I very much like that. Very esoteric imagery. You know, she's what I would qualify as an Enochian demon, sort of the good, bad guy. At least this is the way it's portrayed in that. And you have the whole thing with the clipped wings motif going on, the fallen angel symbolism. Very intentional, very well done by Walt Disney. So, yeah, I mean, these movies are, you know, people, you know, when you're dealing with a child's movie or a child's things, don't think that, you know, this is devoid of it. You know, I mean, one of the things I talked about, you know, in the books, and I think I even talked about it, with you is, you know, things like the Smurfs, you know, which is the Communist Manifesto, for lack of a better word.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's a big study. And, you know, if you're into that stuff, you know, we will definitely talk about it more in the next hour.
I think that would be great because, you know, I the Smurfs especially. I mean, you know, we've done, you know, the comparison of of Elvis Presley's life and the life of Jesus Christ a number of times. It's always one of my favorites.
Yeah, me too.
You know, because when I mention it to people, they actually say, "You got to be kidding me." And I said, "No, he's not saying one is the other. He's just saying their lives had parallels."
Right.
And yeah, I would love for you to do that again, because that to me is one of the my favorites. Well, my son and daughter-in-law live in Nashville, and so, you know, there's Memphis and everything, and it just
Well, what's funny with this is, Barbara, is it's funny you bring the Elvis thing up, because this I finally, it's funny you mentioned this, because when I'm doing Cinema Symbolism 3, I'm actually going to do a whole chapter on Elvis. I'm going to take the material I put in Cinema Symbolism 1, take the part I put in Symbolism 2, I'm going to codify it in a chapter. I'm going to call it something like, you know, Elvis, the New World's Messianic Sun God, or something like that. You know, or Apollo or something like that. Because, you know, this seems like a study for me that never ends. You know, I every time I start looking at this, I see something new constantly is coming up with this, you know, some solar reference or something odd, you know, with Elvis. I seem to be keeping the ball rolling. It seems like it never ends. I'm always finding something new on this.
Well, it is fascinating. And, you know, I can never remember all of it, so, you know, which is, you know, I have to go back and find the show that we did and listen to you again, because the coincidences, which I don't believe there's anything such a thing as coincidence, but the synchronicities between the lives of the two were just amazing.
Absolutely. Do you want to take a break and we can do it after the break?
Sure. You want a break for about 5 minutes?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Let me see. I've got some music here someplace. I can play something for, I can give you, well, why don't we look at all my clips. My longest clip is 2 minutes and 36 seconds. So
that's fine. I just need to get a drink and I'll be right back in about 2 minutes.
Okay. 2 minutes and 36 seconds.
You got it.
Okay. Thank you. And we're back with Robert Sullivan. We're talking about his books, which are fascinating, and I highly recommend them to everybody. I keep twisting my tongue on this. Cinema Symbolism 1 and 2 are both fascinating books. They go into movies, and I promise you, you'll never watch a movie differently. Of course, you want to send him your favorite movies and ask him to please review them for you so that you can see all of the hidden stuff that's in them. I have to admit, he found symbols in so many films that they're still favorites of mine, but I understand them more deeply and I can relate to them better. And when I go to the movies now, I kind of pick out archetypes and I pick out things that we are supposed to, that are there subtly. And it's amazing because a lot of this stuff is put in intentionally to hit you at a subconscious level. And a lot of it isn't, and yet it just appears. It's almost as though sometimes people write this way or produce movies this way without realizing what they're doing. And yet they're triggering stuff in your subconscious that gives you a sense of exactly what this is supposed to represent so that you have a deeper understanding of the purpose of the character in the movie and the situations that they're involved in. So it gives you a better understanding, not only of things in the movies, but then you can take it into real life and you can recognize the same characteristics in people and situations in everyday life. And it gives you a better understanding of sometimes how to deal with them. So it's an amazing education reading his books, and I highly recommend them to everybody.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so give us the Elvis story.
Right. Well, this was something that I did in the first movie book, and then I kind of continued it on in the second book, and I can't remember how this started, but every time I started looking at Elvis, and every time I started just observing him or looking at him and looking at his life, every time I turned around, it was some sort of solar sun reference. And it ties into this whole idea of it's like a, you know, I don't get into Jesus. It's not, you know, it's really not a Jesus reference. It's more what I call Apollo, who is the sun god. He's a Jesus concomitant. And it's, excuse me. And you know, where Apollo was the sun god, but he was also the god of music. And, you know, you look at Elvis and it's like, you know, his whole life is just surrounded by solar iconography. I don't know why it is. I say it's synchronistic. I tie it into Jungian synchronicity, you know, I mean, and it does parallel, you know, you do have this Christian element to it, especially, you know, with his death. And the whole thing just revolves around the sun. And Elvis, I mean, you know, you just look at him later in life, he wears the jumpsuits with the sun on them, you know, or the Mayan calendar, which is a solar reference. You know, when he was coming on the stage at the end there, he was coming into the music by Richard Strauss called Also Sprach Zarathustra. And this is more commonly known to many as the theme to 2001. Mm-hmm. The music that he comes out to is actually called Sunrise, of all things. And, you know, Elvis was born like Jesus under the sign of Capricorn, which is the winter solstice, which is the annual newly resurrected sun. Elvis dies in August, which is the house of Leo, which is ruled by the sun. You know, you have in Egypt, you have the whole parallels with the sun god there, where you have the Nile River with the temples of the sun on, you know, the banks of the Nile. In America, you have the New Nile, the Mississippi, and the Temple of the Sun on the banks of Sun Records, which is where, you know, Elvis crafted his music, you know, the Temple of the Sun. Mm-hmm. It's just this fascinating solar reference that it just turns up over and over again with this man, you know, that his whole life was like this solar parallel. I can't describe it any other way. The one that was really interesting was Elvis's stardom. He really got his first big break where he was announced to the world. You know, what I say he was virgin birth to the world was on September 9th when he appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. And this is where, you know, his superstardom took off. And of course, September 9th Virgo the Virgin. So I thought that was interesting. And it was just all this solar iconography that surrounds the guy. And then, of course, he dies under the house of Leo, which is the sun. And then you have this sort of Christian religion like parallel coming up where is he alive or is he dead? Did he survive his own death? Like Jesus, you make the pilgrimage, the sacred journey to the sacred shrine, Graceland, you know, to visit the grave. I mean, you think of visiting the sepulcher in Jerusalem or something like that. The collection of relics, you know, you get into the Middle Ages with the religious relics, you know, the pieces of the true cross, you know, or, you know, the piece of the saint or what have you. And, you know, it's the same thing with Elvis, you know, the autographs, the memorabilia. I mean, it is this, you know, quasi, you know, I constantly think of pictures of, you know, Jesus crucified, paintings, you know, or engravings or prints. And I always think of the, you know, paintings of Elvis on velvet, you know, you know, and I just can't help but draw a parallel with that. I mean, because it is almost the same thing. It's like this religious, you know, iconography going on. And it was something that I talked about, I brought up in Cinema Symbolism Part 1. I was just studying this. I was just fascinated by this, that this man's life just paralleled, you know, this Jesus, Apollo, you know, solar journey almost. And I can't account for it. You know, I don't know why it is that way. I call it synchronicity. That it just seems to be the way that, you know, the call it God, call it the universe wanted it. I can't, you know, describe it or reconcile it any other way other than to tell you this is all happening. It's not a coincidence. I don't think it is anyway. Right. And what I decided to do was, I mean, this was something that really fascinates me. I talked about it in the first cinema book, and I think I flirted with it again in the second one. And when I was right, I started outlining Cinema Symbolism. I thought, you know what? I thought, you know, Elvis is such a big force in Hollywood. I mean, my goodness, he made a ton of movies. Let me take the material that I put in Cinema Symbolism 1 and 2 and just recodify it and just put it in a brand new chapter in Cinema Symbolism 3. So I fully plan on doing that because I think it is a fascinating study. And I think it is worth revisiting. You know, I have a gut feeling that as I continue to study this, more and more stuff's going to come to light. Because that seems to be the way of it. Whenever I start looking at Elvis and I start researching him, I just constantly am seeing these solar symbols and solar icons and, you know, solar references around him. I don't know why that is, but it is.
Well, I think that there are some people in this life that have an aura about them that does set them apart. And, you can't, I mean, the Beatles, they were the same way. They went through a metamorphosis of an amazing metamorphosis and in their search for themselves and the magic of their music. And, you know, when you listen to the lyrics of a lot of their songs, there's a great deal of spiritual stuff there.
Oh, sure.
It's just, it's amazing. You mentioned Snow White and I was wondering if you put any symbolistic stuff to the number of dwarves.
Yeah, well, the number seven is repeatedly, I mean, the number seven is a magical number. I mean, seven deadly sins, seven cardinal virtues, 7 days of the week. There's a whole litany, you know, of mysticism surrounding the number seven. You know, what is the one? I mean, they wrote a song about it. You know, the seventh son of the seventh son is, you know, is the magician, is the wizard, essentially. There's a lot of mysticism surrounding the number seven. With the seven dwarves, and this is something you'll find, you know, repeated in films. I mean, and Snow White, you know, it's just filled with, you know, archetypal religious, you know, esoteric symbolism. The fact that there were seven dwarves, seven chakras, you know, seven helpers, this is, you know, not surprising to me. You have the Magnificent Seven, seven planets of the ancient world. Seven archetypes, seven deadly sins. We have the movie Seven. This is a magic number, and filmmakers know this. And fairy tales, which is a lot of allegory as well, incorporate this, you know, esoterica in them. So, you know, that should come as no surprise to anybody.
I've often wondered if there is a special office in big studios that look for these kind of symbols that they want to insert into movies in order to grab the consciousness of those that are watching it. I mean, it cannot be a random thing. It has to be something on some level that is intentionally done.
Oh, I agree. And I think it has, I think it can be a collaborative effort. I think it can be, a collaborative effort between the writer or the producer or, the screenwriter or the production designer. There was a, I think I may have mentioned this to you the last time I was on, one of the guys whose movies is, his movies are always overloaded with symbolism. This is who we were just talking about, is Darren Aronofsky with his mother. You know, one of the movies he made was Black Swan, which is just overloaded with stuff. And Aronofsky, it was quite fortuitous when I was doing this in Cinema Symbolism too. Black Swan was a movie that I took on in the first one, and it was overloaded with so much stuff I had to put it in the second one. One of the movies I did in Cinema Symbolism too was this movie. It came out in 2013. It's sort of an indie movie, but it's very good. It was a movie called Stoker. It starred Nicole Kidman, Matthew Good, and Mia Wasikowska. It's very symbolic. And when I was watching this, I started seeing some of the same sort of techniques and things that I was seeing in Black Swan. And sure enough, I discovered it was the same project designer or set designer. I forget her name. She recently died, unfortunately. But the same person who had done this movie, I recognized her hand. I'm watching Stoker and I'm thinking to myself, I've seen some of this before somewhere. And she did Black Swan. I know Aronofsky is doing it on purpose. And the guy who directed Stoker was an Oriental director named Chan Park Wook. And he's into esoterica and he incorporates a lot of mysticism in his films. I mean, the one movie, Stoker, is very overloaded with alchemical themes, referencing other movies. It's a very well done film. If you've never seen it, I'd recommend it. It could be a little slow moving, but it is very interesting. I very much liked it. A very symbolic movie. There's one of the, people who's doing this was the set designer. And clearly she is following the vision of these directors who are intentionally incorporating this esoteric in their films. Because, I mean, Aronofsky, I mean, my goodness gracious. I mean, you look at Black Swan, which is overloaded. Wait till you see, if you haven't seen it yet, or the listeners, take a look at the movie Mother. My goodness gracious. I mean, that movie is nothing but symbolic.
Wow. What about Bates Motel?
Well, that's funny you mentioned that too, because this is something I'm going to do in part three. Was I talked about Hitchcock in the other two books, with Psycho, and Hitchcock plays around with some symbolism as well. Mm-hmm. The Bates Motel was a show that aired on A&E, and I was a big fan of it. I have all the discs here on it. I love that show. But what was very interesting with that was I watched all seasons of it, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and episode and years 1, 2, 3, and 4 were good shows, very good, but there was really nothing esoteric going on, at least nothing that I could see going on. But when I got to season 5, and this is when it caught up with Psycho, every episode had esoteric symbolism in it. It was just overloaded with it. So, there was enough there. I remember watching it, and my goodness gracious, they really have gone overboard with this. So Bates Motel is something that I plan on taking on in Cinema Symbolism Part 3. I think it's funny you mentioned this. I was toying around with the chapter the other day. I think I'm going to call it something like Easter Eggs Hidden in the Bates Motel or something. Although that had kind of a nice ring to it. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example of this. In Bates Motel, the season 5 episode, the very first episode, started with Norman Bates putting a record on a record player. And the record is like Plainview Recordings, I think. Hang on, let me look at this real fast. It was, hang on, I'll know in a minute. It was Plainfield Recordings. And that's a reference to Ed Gein, who was from Plainfield, Wisconsin. And Ed Gein is the basis for Norman Bates. He was a real serial killer who was obsessed with his mother. So that was a very esoteric homage right off the bat to Ed Gein. And I remember seeing that right off the bat. I thought, oh, great. You know, here's a little occult reference to Ed Gein, Norman Bassett's real life analog. And then when I was watching the show, I mean, they had the one character working at a company, the Marion Crane character. She was working at a company called R.A. Block. That's Robert Block. That's the guy who wrote Psycho. So that was a good little reference there. And then there is a really great scene. We've talked about this before, I believe, Barbara. I'm sure I've mentioned this on other shows. You know, it's not only symbolism in film. I mean, it can be costuming can have an esoteric effect. You know, a setting can have an esoteric effect. The actor cast can be produced an occult purpose, and certainly a music can be done for an occult purpose. And in Bates Motel, we had this in season 5. This is when he stabs the guy in the shower. This is when you have the breakdown of reality for him, where he crosses over and knows the mother character is a phantom and that he's essentially crazy. And it's the breakdown of reality. And when this is happening, in the show, the music that is playing of all things is Roy Orbison's Crying. And that is a direct reference to David Lynch, to Mulholland Drive, when Roy Orbison's Crying is playing in between when the Naomi Watts character is coming out of the fantasy into reality. And this is what is happening with Norman Bates, where he's crossing over from reality to fantasy. And that is intentionally done. I recognized that immediately. I thought, oh, that's very clever with Roy Orbison's Crying right there.
Wow.
That is a clear reference to Blue Velvet, or not Blue Velvet, I'm sorry, Mulholland Drive by David Lynch. It has to do with the breakdown of reality, because that song is playing exactly when the Naomi Watts character is breaking down the fantasy world and entering reality. And this is when Norman Bates is having the real world awakening that the mother is dead and that he's actually killing the people. That is intentionally done, and that is very well done by those filmmakers.
Well, you know, so many of us, at least before I read your books and stuff, the thought of making a movie was, you know, you tell a story and you make pretty scenery and you put pretty music. I mean, it never occurred to me how much thought and attention had to be paid to every last detail in order to hit that subconscious in everybody. I mean, you know, it's very easy when you're watching a movie and you see an Apple computer or a Diet Coke, or, you know, because they pay money to have their
right.
their stuff there. And, you know, I always recognize that. It was like, I wonder how much they paid for that one. But the other stuff, the music, or the lack of music, is really profound, and it does put you in a different frame of mind. Now, there's a study out there that says all you need is 45 seconds to stare at the television screen before you are put into an alpha theta state. Which
that
is
wouldn't
like,
surprise me.
Light hypnosis. And the same thing would be said for a movie theater. Within 45 seconds, you're in a light hypnotic trance, and you are highly suggestible.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, what you're referring to is like product placement, where this is where like a movie, you know, where like Coke will pay the movie makers, you know, X amount of dollars to have their character, you know, drink a Diet Coke or something. That's really not what I'm talking about. You know, when I get into the symbolism, it's, you know,
oh, yeah.
you know, is the music done for esoteric purposes? Is the actor, you know, the actor can draw on previous performance and convey an esoteric meaning. And absolutely. I mean, you know, what you're telling me about hypnosis, absolutely. I mean, these filmmakers know it. I mean, these guys are very adroit with this. I know you haven't seen the movie, but, when you get around to watching it, and this is something I talked about on, you know, I mean, this just goes to show you the detail is, I mean, and this is one of the whole major themes of the movie is if you want, when you're watching Mother by Darren Aronofsky, pay attention to the Ed Harris character. He has a cigarette lighter and there's a symbol on that lighter, and that's the whole movie. is what that symbol is. That ties into a ton of themes going on in that movie. And that's very well hidden, and that's very intentional. But you know, when you figure out what that symbol is, you're gonna start figuring out what that movie is really all about. So yeah, these guys go to great lengths to do it. Some guys are more sophisticated than others. And like I said, it was interesting with Bates Motel because like season 1, 2, 3, and 4 really didn't have anything going on. And it's the great shows, but season 5 was just overloaded. With esoteric symbolism, esoteric imagery, and they just really went all in on it. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, why did they do that? Why did they wait till season 5 to really throw the kitchen sink in? And I think it had to do with they were paying homage to Alfred Hitchcock, because that was when in season 5 was when they called it the Psycho. And I think they just kind of saved everything for season 5 to sort of, to honor Alfred Hitchcock. That's my take on it. That's the only thing I could come up with.
Did they change producers?
You know, I'd have to go look at that. I don't think they did. I mean, I think it was still the same production people and the same directors and people like that. I don't think it changed. I think they just waited till the end. To when it caught up the Psycho to just go all in with the esoteric symbolism. Just off the top of my head, I remember, you know, a lot of it involves around death, and it took place in the winter months, you know, with mm-hmm. the death of the sun. They played on that theme. That's no surprise. They played around with the music. There's some other stuff going on in that, I'm trying to recall. There was in Psycho, there was, In the movie Psycho was the first movie that ever showed a toilet flushing. And there was in that's true. And in Bates Motel season 5, there was, I believe they actually bragged that there was a video angle through a toilet bowl. And that was the first ever done. And they said they were doing that to honor Psycho with Hitchcock for that. That they came out and admitted that one. There was a piece of occult casting in Bates Motel season 5. I'm going to keep that to myself. You'll have to read about that in Cinema Symbolism 3. But okay. Yeah, in Bates Motel, in that last season 5, they went all in on the esoteric symbolism.
Wow. Well, now Alfred Hitchcock, I keep thinking about the birds and, you know, that movie to me had so many messages all over the place.
It's been so long since I've seen it. I couldn't talk about it, but I mean, if I know Hitchcock, I mean, I know he has stuff in Vertigo. I mean, he has stuff in Psycho. He likes to play around with people's clothing, especially women's clothing. When they start out as Miss Goody Two-Shoe, they're in the white, you know, the white underwear, the white costuming. But when they do something evil, now it's the black underwear. You'll find that in Psycho. And there's another movie that he does it in. I forget which one it is, but he does the same thing in it. A Vertigo has spiral in the hair. That's done all over the place. Hitchcock played around with this stuff too. And he knew what he was doing with it. It's been so long since I've seen The Birds. I'd have to go take a look at that. But I would have little doubt there isn't stuff going on in that on an esoteric level.
Well, just the fact that they're ravens, and you know the ravens have are symbolic to Native Americans, and you know there's just that movie keeps flashing. So you know, I thought I would mention it. but I'm fascinated with how do you pick these movies? How do you determine what it is you're going to go looking for?
It's fun. I don't really think I pick them. I think they pick me. The reason I say that is, I mean, I only analyze movies that I'm 100% convinced that this material is presented in. So I only analyze movies that I see it in. And I don't analyze it in movies that I don't see it in. So if I see a movie and I start watching it and I believe there's esoteric symbolism in it or an esoteric theme or archetypes, the monomyth or something, yeah, I'll take it on. But if I watch a movie and I don't think there's anything worth talking about, I don't talk about it. There are movies out there that I very much enjoy that I think are very good movies that don't really have a whole lot going on an esoteric level. I mean, I think of, you know, something like Reservoir Dogs by Quentin Tarantino. I think it's a terrific film. I very much like it. Really, really not much for me to write about in it. So I leave it alone. Mm-hmm. I only really take on the movies where I see it, you know, and I've got to watch it more than once. And, you know, there's always almost when I watch them, you know, like an aha moment, you know, where I see, okay, now, you know, where there'll be like a dead giveaway. And that's when I know, okay, now I know these guys, this movie's up to something. And, you know, it's like Mother with the cigarette lighter, or, you know, in Star Wars with the monomyth, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, the Matrix with Gnosticism, you know, when I can start breaking the movie down and putting it in its context. And that, Barbara, is what is so critical to this, is finding the right context of the symbolism. You know, am I dealing with a Kabbalistic movie? Am I dealing with an alchemical film? Am I dealing with a monomyth? Am I dealing with movies that involve, you know, secret societies or secret society symbolism? Am I dealing with numbers? And if so, why? You know, and is the number, what if there's numbers in it, what is it signifying? This is all critical to me in the research. And you know, I take on the movies that I see that these directors are concealing the material in. And if I don't see it, I don't talk about it. So to answer that, I kind of think like the movies almost select me. And sometimes it jumps right off the screen at me. I remember seeing the Star Wars movie, the last one, not The Last Jedi, The Force Awakens. I remember watching it for the first time. I think, oh, yeah. I mean, they've really got a lot going on in this thing. I mean, I could see it, you know, plain as day in front of my eyes. So I thought, okay, this is one I can take on. Other movies, it's much more hidden in. So, you know, each movie is a challenge. And, you know, there's always some, you know, kind of like tip off that I can start seeing in them. And then I can, you know, piecing it together off of that. I remember when I was watching Crimson Peak by Guillermo del Toro. I remember watching that for the first time, and I remember seeing ads for it. I remember just watching it, the ads. I thought even the ads, I could see that there was stuff going on in this. And I remember sitting there watching the movie, and there was a lot going on with the costuming in the movie and a lot of symbolism, you know, and I remember getting up about to the middle portion of that movie. I remember watching the scene. I had notes in front of me. I was, you know, analyzing it. I had it here on Blu-ray. And I remember getting up about to the halfway point, and there was the scene where the Mia Wasikowska character, who's a writer, goes into this green bathroom and watches this female ghost come up out of the tub and scare her off. And I remember just thinking to myself, I know I've seen this before. Where was it? And of course, it's The Shining. Yeah. It's where Jack Nicholson goes into the, you know, green bathroom and the female ghost comes up and scares him and he runs off. I remember pausing the movie right then and there. And I just remember thinking to myself, you know, wait a minute, I'm analyzing this thing symbolically and I know I'm on the right track. But I thought to myself, am I watching a remake of The Shining here? And I just started scanning the movie and just started remembering all these parallels. And I actually stopped the movie and I put the notes aside and I just started writing. I started the movie all over again, and I just started making notes about parallels with this movie with The Shining. And the whole movie was just like a remake of The Shining, and I know it was intentional. I mean, I know Guillermo del Toro was including this deep homage to Kubrick's movie in that. And it was a fascinating study, and I just loved doing it. But that was the tip-off for me. You know, that's a lot of the ways it happens when I'm doing it.
Wow. Well, you know, now, have you done the Da Vinci Code?
Yeah, that was a movie that I originally took on in the Royal Arch of Enoch. Uh-huh. That is a movie that has secret society symbolism in it. It's one of those movies where, excuse me, I need a drink of water here. Where with Da Vinci Code. That has a lot going on in it as the same National Treasure movie. The number 13 turns up all over the place in that movie, and it's a reference to this high degree Masonic ritual, which is the furthering of education, wisdom providing. I remember the number 13 turning up all over the place. I'd have to go back and look at it, but Da Vinci Code was something that I took on in the Royal Arch of Enoch book. That was the last chapter of it. And yeah, mm-hmm. that had esoteric symbolism in it as well. I liked the movie. It wasn't great, but I liked it. And there was enough symbolism in it where I took it on, and you know, it's been a while since I've seen the movie. It's been a while since I've looked at the last chapter of the Royal Arch, but I did take a look at you know, at this, and you know, a great, interesting movie symbolically.
Well, the reason I asked is his wasn't his next book, or it may have been Inferno was a book that he wrote after that, and basically same character. And I found the book amazing. The movie, they changed the ending, and I couldn't believe it. I sat there in the movie theater and I said, "Oh no, this is wrong."
Right. I haven't read the book or seen the movie, so I'm gonna have to take a pass on that. But I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess for dramatic purposes, you know, whatever, they change it. You know, I have no idea.
In that particular movie, I believe they changed the ending because they didn't want to scare the public, because the ending of the book probably has happened.
Oh, really? Wow.
And it was a major change in the end of the book. Major change. And so if you're gonna, if you know, I would read the book and forget about the movie, because although I found it fascinating that they made such a radical change in the ending. I mean, it wasn't a subtle change, it was an absolute change. It totally changed the ending, absolutely. And to me, it ruined the whole story.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't seen the book. I haven't seen the book. I haven't seen the movie or read the book. So you know, it'd have to be something that I'll take a look at. But you know, I don't know. You know, I the only movie that I saw of his was Da Vinci Code. I did like it. I mean, I did like the symbolism in it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's been a while since I've watched it, and that was something that's at the end of the Royal Arch of Enoch. If you're interested in Da Vinci Code, take a look at that one. Take a look at Royal Arch of Enoch. That's where you'll find my breakdown of that one.
Yeah, I knew that you had done
yeah.
it, because I read the Royal Arch. So, but it to me, it was kind of like it followed the movie followed the book, and there was the symbolism there. And I didn't catch all of it, but I caught a lot of it. And so when Inferno came out, I could see the symbolism in the book as it was going along, and I thought, oh, Robert's going to have fun with this one. And the ending was outrageously great. I mean, it was a good ending. And so I looked forward to the movie, and the movie, you know, went clipped right along until the very end, and they changed the ending. And all I could think of is, they were hiding something by changing it.
Huh. That's interesting. You can tell me. I mean, I haven't read it, but I mean, you can tell me if you want to.
Well, yeah. In the book, the whole premise is that this really rich man, has decided the earth is overpopulated, and he creates a virus that is going to be released. And, it will cull the population, and they interpret it as, you know, it's going to be a pandemic. It's going to kill, you know, 3/4 of the population, so that, you know, the country and the world can survive. And they're chasing all, and this rich guy kills himself, so that there is no way they have to follow the clues to find where he's hidden the virus to be released. And they go all over. I mean, the movie is phenomenal. They go all over the place following different symbols, and being attacked by people who are trying to prevent them from preventing the virus to be released. And they get to a place in Paris where it is hidden, and they try to, you know, cordon off the area so that fewer people will be, you know, infected. And in the book, they get there, and, the virus has already been released. They're too late. And it is spread worldwide. And it is not a virus that kills people outright like the plague. It sterilizes people.
Oh.
Like 90% of the people. In the movie, they get all the way to where the virus is. And in the movie, they stop it. It's not released.
Right.
I mean,
yeah, I guess they kind of wanted maybe like a little more happy ending, I suppose.
Well, no, I think that, you know, I do believe that there is, there are those who are trying to cull the population to a certain extent. If you look, there's so many more people having trouble getting pregnant these days than ever used to be. And I think that in some of the, you know, the shots that we get, there may be something there that has definitely, you know, turned off our ability to have children.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, you know, could there be some sort of hidden agenda for that? You know, fascinating. I have no idea, but, you know, certainly. And it sounds like an interesting movie and an interesting book. But like I said, I haven't seen, you know, I'll have to get around to watching it. It sounds, you know, pretty interesting, but, I mean, it could be, who knows?
I mean, in the book, you know, they test everybody's blood and the virus is already in their blood and it's not going to kill them. It just sterilizes them. Not everybody.
Right.
But a great percentage of people, so that nobody's killed, but the population is gently culled.
Right.
So, I mean, which is a better ending than to, oh, we got saved. The virus is, you know, oh, I was so disappointed.
Well, I remember they did that with the guy who wrote the one. I didn't read it, but my father had the same experience with the movie. It was the book and the movie was called, it was the sequel to Silence of the Lambs. It was Hannibal, uh-huh. Where the ending was different than what was in the movie. And he said the same thing. He said it was, you know, he liked the ending in the book much better than he liked the one in the movie. And the one in the movie was when the one in the book was much darker than the one in the movie. And they changed it around in the movie and he didn't like it, but it was the same sort of thing, where the ending was much darker, than what had happened in the movie. They changed the movie ending around to make it more kind of like upbeat, you know, or,
well,
you know, different. And, you know,
the theater was not full where we were. And I went, oh no. And maybe 8 or 10 other people said, oh, they wrecked it. You know, because I was not the only one that had read the book too. And you know, it was like, oh, I left it. I wanted to get my money back. To me, they ruined the entire movie.
Yeah.
But you know, it was, I was right there with them. I was into the symbology. I saw the you know, the masonry stuff. I saw all of the, you know, I was picking up on it all, because of course it was in the book. But then when the ending came and they had changed it so radically, it was like, why?
Yeah, it's probably just because they didn't want to have like a downer ending. That's the main reason. That would be the reason I could think of. But, you know, Hollywood, you know, does do that. They do tweak movies around. And, you know, sometimes people like them more than the book. Sometimes they don't. But, you know, I know they did that with Hannibal. It was Hannibal. You're like, where they changed the altered the ending to what it was in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also, I mean, you know, Kubrick changed all kinds of things around in The Shining. So, artistic license, I suppose, but you know, you have people who are fans of the book. My father loved the book of Hannibal, but he hated the movie. And mm-hmm. It sounds like you had the same experience with Inferno. So
I was good with it all the way up to the very ending, and then I was angry. I was absolutely angry leaving the theater. And you know, but with the books that you analyze, I think it has made me, reading your books and talking to you so much has made me so much more aware of what is going on in the movies, what is being put out there for us to absorb. What is the message that is there beyond the storyline?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And it is really, you know, I can do it well with a lot of movies. I'm just dying for you to watch those two movies. I keep pushing on you, and it's only been 2 years, 3 years that I've been pushing them on you.
Oh, I'll take a look at them. I know. I mean, I definitely plan on watching them. It's just, you know, it's just, you know, time and, you know, but I mean, I have them definitely in my notes there for Cinema Symbolism 3. So I'll definitely take a look at them. And there was another one, Prometheus. I know there was another one someone had asked me about. So I'll take a look at that as well. So, yeah, no, I mean, I know some of the movies that I'm going to cover, but yeah, I'll definitely take a look at them and see what, if anything, I find. But yeah, it's a, you know, that was my motivation. One of my motivations for writing these books was to point out this esoteric symbolism going on, that you're watching more than just celluloid. You're watching more than what you're just seeing on the screen. These movies have deep esoteric mythological undercurrents. You should be aware of that. And I just thought it was just so fascinating to me. I mean, I guess the thing that just so much interested me was to the, just the absolute level these guys will go to incorporate this stuff, and how, and like you said, it's not a coincidence. These guys are tuned into this stuff. You know, these guys know what they're doing, and it's not a coincidence. I mean, these guys are very, very adroit with a lot of the symbolism, and it was just a fascinating study for me. It was for the first book. It was for the second book, and I know it will be for the third book.
Well, it's so fascinating in that, you know, it's like they have a blank piece of paper and it's like, what do I want to tell people that they aren't knowing they're being told? And it comes down to, as you said, music, scenery, costumes, subtleties.
Oh, sure.
And so it's not just, you know, dress people up pretty and have them read their lines. It's, what is the story that's going on here underneath the story?
Oh, I agree with you. Yeah.
And that's what blows me away. It's kind of like, you know, what are they trying to tell me here? I mean, yeah, I read the book and stuff like that, but what is the message the movie is trying to tell me? What is it trying to open me up to? What kind of inner truth is it that I am, that it has seeded within my consciousness? And it's always quite amazing. The more you think about it, the more that you ponder it, the more that you kind of go back into and relive some of the scenes in the movie, you begin to understand the message that is being given without words or dialogue or anything else. But there's a subtlety there that tells you about life. And
I totally agree, and I think it's you know for me, I just love the, you know, I mean, I agree, it's just the movies can be filled with these, you know, symbolic esoteric undercurrents, and I think in many cases, you know, the filmmakers are doing this, I think they do it as a challenge. I think they're trying to challenge the audience to, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? To see if you can't decode this stuff. I mean, I think they really, you know, like doing it. I mean, I don't think this is, you know, so I think for a filmmaker incorporating this stuff, I mean, I do it with my books. So, you know, I know that, you know, I mean, I do it intentionally. So I know that these guys are doing it. And I think it is a challenge to see if you can't decode this stuff on their behalf, to say, you know, okay, here's the film. You know, look beneath the surface, look beneath the storyline, and see if you can't pick up on these esoteric undercurrents, themes, symbols to convey these other messages to you. I think it's just a fascinating study. And again, it's part of the motivation I did for writing the first two books and, you know, for writing the third one.
Well, and you get to watch movies a lot too, and that's a cool thing as well.
Yeah, I mean, I like watching movies, and it's certainly, you know, something that I like doing, and I'm a big, you know, cinephile, and you know, it's I always have been as a child. I you know, grew up on Star Wars and things like that. So, you know, breaking these movies down is something I very much enjoy doing, and you know, discovering this esoteric stuff. And like I said, it's just, you know, it fascinates me, and you know, I wrote two books about it, and I'm working on a third one, and who knows, I might be working on a fourth one. I was just going over this the other day for Cinema Symbolism 3. I was actually toying around with the cover of it, and I was toying around with the title of it. I'll tell you this story. And I did Cinema Symbolism, and I had the subtitle as A Guide to Esoteric Imagery in Popular Movies. I liked that. I thought, okay, that's good. So then when I did Cinema Symbolism 2, I did the subtitle of more esoteric imagery in popular movies. So now I'm on Cinema Symbolism 3, and I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, now what's the subtitle going to be? You know, I can't do even more, you know, esoteric symbolism in movies. So I started playing around with this the other day, and I thought, okay, this works. We'll do a little bit of a break. So I thought we'll call it Cinema Symbolism 3. I was toying around with something like, esoteric imagery in Hollywood Unveiled or something like that. I was toying around with that. I can't go with even more esoteric symbolism. So I'm toying around with the subtitle. I already started playing around with the cover of the book, getting that in a bit of an order. So yeah, I'm working on it, and it will come out, but I am tagging, you know, also playing around with some other projects as well. So we'll see what happens.
Well, you could always do Cinema Symbolism 3, The Journey Continues.
Yeah. I'm playing around with that, and we'll see what's up. But I've already got some ideas for the cover. I'm liking the way it's coming out. Like I said, I already wrote the chapter on Mother. I did that. And if your audience has a chance, by all means, check that one out. That movie is completely symbolic. I mean, that's one of those movies where the film is of itself symbolic, and there's symbolism in it. So, I mean, that's like, you know, a Thanksgiving dinner for me, you know, picking that thing apart. Very, 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 very fun doing that. So, yeah, Cinema Symbolism 3 we're working on. The Pact with the Devil sequel, and you know, some of these backstories, and this other project, and another book on masonry. So plenty to work on, and it'll all come out in due course.
Wow. What's your projected publish date for the second book on the covens?
Well, right now that's probably a little far off. What is happening is I'm kind of like writing all four of them at once, but it's just, you know, like a piece here and a piece there. This fifth book, this is the one that I can't talk about. This is the one that I'm kind of putting the most time in right now, but I can't talk about it. This is either going to pick up big time in the next couple months, where I'm going to try to have this out hopefully before the end of the year, but if not, probably early 19. But I have a feeling that in the coming months, this project is going to take over, and the other four are going to go on the back burner. However, if that happens, I can talk about it. I can come on shows and talk about it, because this is a mind blower. This is a fascinating story. I mean, and this comes out of the world of, quite literally, you can't make this stuff up. And this is reality. This isn't a movie. So, mm-hmm. I've got a feeling that I'm going to be on a lot of shows talking about this. But I'll know more in the next coming months. But if it plays out like I think it will, this is going to be the thing that is going to take up all my time. And then at that point in time, I'll be probably working on the sequel and a pact with the sequel and Tales from the Black Flame. That'll all come. But this project is most likely going to take up my time starting in about a month. I've already started working on it. I've already written a chapter on it. I mean, I've started researching it, but unfortunately I can't talk about it.
Okay. Okay. Well, when you can, I'll have you back and we can do that. I just, the clock is running out here, and, I want to, thank you especially. And if people want to get a hold of you, they can find you on robertsullivaniv.com, right?
Yes, my website is www.robertwsullivaniv.com. It is links there to buy the books, links there for upcoming appearances. It's a a very easy website to navigate, www.robertwsullivaniv.com. Go there, links to buy the books, links for upcoming events I'm going to be on, radio shows, my biography, links to follow me on social media. By all means, check it out, www.robertwsullivaniv.com.
Wow. Well, you certainly have a lot of pokers in the fire. I mean, you do have time to actually work too, right?
Yes, I do.
My goodness. I mean, I think though, when you get in this kind of a flow, when you have this, your creative energy and your juices flowing like you do, it kind of energizes all aspects of life. So, you know, it's kind of exciting because you actually can leap tall buildings at a single bound when you have this kind of energy flowing.
Yeah, I mean, I like doing it. It's something that I'm very passionate about, and you know, I'm really excited about writing these books, and you know, it's a dream of mine, and I'm thrilled to be able to live the dream. And like I said, by all means, check out the books. It's, you know, and you know, you can go there on my website. If you also, you know, I mean, I think this is how I found you. If you run a you know, if you have a podcast and you want to have me on, send me some information. I'd love to come on as a guest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, www.robertwsullivaniv.com. And, you know, I have a feeling I'll be coming back on your show in the near future.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it because it's always a pleasure and a joy. And, you know, pumping you for material on all of these movies is amazing. I have to go watch Mother now. And you know, it's kind of... It's always exciting because you always have something new to offer, and there is so much material out there. It is amazing. And, you know, and I love the fact that most of the stuff that you are reviewing, I've read the books of. That to me is so cool because it gives me a double perspective, which is really kind of fun as well. But I do want to thank you. And I do want to thank everybody who listened. And this will go up on YouTube later on tonight or tomorrow.
Excellent.
So it'll be on my YouTube channel. And I look forward to having you back.
Oh, absolutely. And I'd love to come back on. And once the YouTube video is up, I will definitely spread that around. I'll put it on Twitter. I'll put it on Facebook. I'll archive it. I'll have it on my channel. And absolutely, you'd love to come back on. And thank you, Barbara, for having me on. It's always a pleasure to be on. I enjoy, love doing your shows. And again, thank you for having me on. And I'd love to come on in the near future.